Chapter 13, a chapter in which it is night, and therefore not all that is happening can be seen. Night had fallen suddenly and completely. The crescent moon was giving all the light it could, and the stars were shining. Big Tiger and Christian had never before seen such a starry sky. "There are a lot more stars here than in Peking," said Christian. "Let's look for the pole star," Big Tiger suggested. "My teacher says it stays in its place and all the other stars move around it." Christian agreed eagerly. "We must stand up then," he said. "The pole star is somewhere in front of us. We can't see it from here." Both stood up, leaned their arms on the metal drums, and scanned the sky for the pole star. But it was impossible to find it, as the glare from the headlights dazzled them, and beyond this glare the sky was black as ink. The telegraph poles, some straight and some bent, flew past them on the right. To the left, wheel tracks stretched along the road like flowing ribbons. Suddenly the moon became obscured and dark orange-colored. It seemed veiled by floating gray clouds. Then all of a sudden it disappeared behind the cloud bank to the west. At the same time, the fair wind rose. "I don't understand what's happening," said Big Tiger. "It's snowing," cried Christian. In a trice, everything was blotted out by whirling snowflakes. Big Tiger pointed to the little window through which they could see the rim of Good Fortune's cap and his hands on the steering wheel. His right hand now reached for the handbrake. With his left hand, he tried to keep the steering straight, but this was impossible. The truck skidded, and there was a crash. It had run into a telegraph pole. One of the headlights went out. The other still glowed quietly, lighting up the damaged telegraph pole, which hung slantwise over the truck, held only by its wires. "It can't be helped," said Good Fortune coolly. "It's an unlucky day for traveling. It says so in the calendar." "What do you mean by it can't be helped? You promised me we'd reach White Stone today. How is it to be done?" "Only heaven and this telegraph pole knows that." And that was that. For the time being, as far as Good Fortune was concerned. He climbed out and went in front to survey the damage. "It's not so bad," he said when he came back. "The bumper is bent and one of the lights is smashed. We'll sleep for an hour or two. Do you hear me, you two up there?" "We hear you, honored sir," answered Big Tiger and Christian. Good Fortune got in again. He turned out the remaining light and then they heard him settling down. Christian and Big Tiger spread out the sleeping bags. Over them they spread their coats, with a tarpaulin to hold them down. Then they slipped off their shoes and wriggled into the warm bags, pulled their fur caps over their faces, and fell asleep. It had become dark in the driver's cab. The wind had blown snow over the windshield, and Greencoat could not see out. This irritated him still more. True, he could hear the wind whistling and the telegraph wires humming as if current were still passing through them, but he did not notice that the snow had eased off. When at last it occurred to him, after half an hour, to open the window, only a few stray flakes blew in. "Hey!" he shouted, shaking Good Fortune's arm. "Wake up! It stopped snowing!" Good Fortune was tired. He would have preferred to turn back to Changbei, but Greencoat gave him no peace. He shouted so loudly that Christian woke up too. "You promised to drive me to Whitestone, and you know I've got business there. The gate of Changbei is shut long ago." "Leave me alone," cried Good Fortune crossly. "Your business at Whitestone is nothing to me." "That's true enough," said Greencoat scornfully. "But it is your business to drive more carefully. This truck may easily lose in value." "What do you mean? Do you—" began Good Fortune loudly and indignantly. But then he thought better of it and lowered his voice, and Christian could catch nothing more. This went on for 2 or 3 minutes. Then Good Fortune got out to start up the motor. Greencoat also made himself busy, and the quarrel seemed to have died down for the time. Greencoat swept the snow from the hood, wiped the windshield, and held back the broken telegraph pole to allow the truck to reverse. Christian lifted his fur cap slightly, nudged Big Tiger, and said, "Listen, Big Tiger, they've been quarreling. Greencoat said the truck would lose in value if Good Fortune didn't drive more carefully." "Is that all?" "Yes, that's all, and we're snowed in, but I'll stay where I am." "So shall I," said Big Tiger. And so they remained snug in their sleeping bags and slept most of the time. They became wide awake only when Good Fortune sounded the horn and the truck began to pursue an erratic course for what seemed like an interminable time. The drums banged together, and someone shouted, "A little to the southwest! Stop! Move on! Just a little!" Christian thought it was the host of the two little silver dishes who was shouting, and Big Tiger dreamed he was walking up to the pass, and there at the top was Lo Chang with a stick as thick as a tree. He opened his eyes quickly, and when he saw nothing but darkness and felt the warm fur tickling his face, he threw back his fur cap. He was glad then that Christian was lying beside him, and Christian was glad to see Big Tiger. Above them they saw the dark, threatening night sky, across which ragged clouds were scurrying. A man with a paper lantern was running in front of the truck, and when Good Fortune switched off the headlight, they could see the lantern swaying like a stray star. The truck stopped, and the man came nearer. It was the host of the inn, Joyous Prosperity, at White Stone. When he turned his lantern on the faces of the nocturnal guests, Greencoat shouted angrily, "Hey, you clown, lower that lantern at once, understand? No one is to know I'm here."
"Sorry, sir, very sorry," stammered the innkeeper in alarm. "I didn't know. How was I to guess that you would be favoring my poor, wretched inn with a visit so early in the year, and in a horseless car, too? It's easy to see—"
"Shut your mouth," Greencoat interrupted, "and show us to our room."
"If you'll excuse me, sir, but the room, you mean, the one with the warmed conch—"
"Yes, of course that's the one," cried Greencoat. "I wouldn't have any other."
"But that little room, your excellency," lamented the innkeeper, "that lovely warm room is occupied—"
"Throw out whoever is in it," commanded Greencoat.
"I daren't do that. 5 or 6 little barbarians, a whole crowd of Mongols, are sleeping in it."
"We'll throw them out," said Good Fortune, tapping his pistol. "Go on ahead and light us."
"On my knees, I beg for mercy. They're my good guests."
"You mean they pay you?"
"I beg your generous forgiveness. No, these guests don't pay. But as for turning them out, you might as well expect an ant to shift a mountain."
"Pray, who then are these mighty gentlemen?" asked Greencoat contemptuously.
"Are they armed?" asked Good Fortune.
The innkeeper assumed a solemn and important air. "No, none of the gentlemen is armed," he said in a low voice, "and they didn't intend to put up here. I am far too unworthy of that, but the snowstorm forced them to stop here." "Speak up," urged Greencoat.
"It is Yolros Lama who has come, the abbot, the living Buddha."
A note says, "Living Buddha, or Gagans, abbots in Tibet and Mongolia, who are venerated as reincarnations of their predecessors."
"The living Buddha of the Balin Sum Monastery, and there's a real prince with him, and his suite, all high Mongolian lamas. I simply can't help it, your excellency."
"That's true," muttered Greencoat, stopping to reflect. "Let it be," he said then, turning to Good Fortune. "There's nothing we can do. My business might suffer, you understand, if I made any unpleasantness." "The devil take your business," said Good Fortune crossly. "I want to go to bed." "Show us into the other room," Greencoat ordered the innkeeper. "You should have got the Kong there walled in long ago. Let's hope you've at least got blankets and fur covers."
"I'd give your excellency the clothes off my back," the host assured him.
He raised his lantern and led them through the courtyard, which was crammed with snow-covered baggage and bales. On reaching the low front of the house, which enclosed the courtyard to the north, they walked along under the projecting eaves until they reached the last door.
"I'm dying to know what's happening," said Christian, and he crawled out of his sleeping bag and knelt behind the barrier of drums.
At first he could distinguish nothing but the dimly lit doorway through which Greencoat and Good Fortune were disappearing like shadows. Then the door closed. Everything sank into inky darkness, and suddenly Christian noticed that Big Tiger was kneeling beside him.
"Kui Chan," he whispered, "I'm curious too. Isn't it awful?"
"We'll be all right. Can you see anything?"
"I can see very little. There are a lot of bales lying about, and there's some round thing, I don't know what it is, and there must be camels somewhere, but I can only hear them."
"They're lying in the south corner," said Christian. "I can hear them, too. They're making a noise like grinding corn."
"All night they keep chewing over again the food they've eaten in the day," explained Big Tiger.
"Cows do that, too," said Christian, "but not so loudly."
"What are we to do now, Kui Chan?" asked Big Tiger anxiously.
"I'm thinking of that the whole time," said Christian. "We're in a desperate fix, and it's so dark.
And it's snowing again. How on earth are we to find Dogalon now?" "Keep quiet," said Big Tiger in alarm, grabbing Christian's arm. "The round thing down there is stirring."
"It's a barrel," said Christian, "and barrels can't move about."
"They can, perhaps, if there's someone inside them," suggested Big Tiger.
"It's shaking itself," cried Christian, horrified. "It's an animal."
They both remained kneeling, looking down at the thing in the courtyard below, which was shaking itself and throwing off the snow. They were frightened. They were clearly aware of that, for they felt their spines going hot and cold. It was good that they were perched high up, and that the thing down below in the yard was a fair distance away and apparently couldn't fly. When it stopped shaking itself, it fell over slowly on its side, and while it lay there, not stirring any more, something wriggled out from under it. It ran along on all fours and disappeared quickly behind the nearest bale. Then it raised its head cautiously, peered around, and, thinking it was unobserved, ran quickly to the next bale, where it stopped again. Just as Christian was about to say with relief, "It's a dog," it stood upright. It was a human being. It ran straight as a dart toward their truck and disappeared under it. Christian and Big Tiger could no longer see it, but they could hear it panting and scratching round by the number plate. Apparently it was looking for a foothold by which to clamber up on the truck.
"Should I shout?" whispered Christian, but Big Tiger put a hand over his mouth.
Two hands appeared on the edge of the truck, then a fur cap, and after that two eyes, which fastened themselves on Christian and Big Tiger. Their gaze seemed peaceable, but it was hard to know for certain, as it was so dark and snow was falling again. All was silent. Only the wind blew, and the camel's jaws continued grinding. It was far more terrifying than the night they walked through the railway tunnel.
"It can't be helped," murmured Big Tiger, pressing more closely to Christian, and they both gazed as if bewitched at the uncanny face which was slowly propelling itself upwards. When the chin reached the edge of the truck, a fresh, boyish voice said, "Hamaga!"
"Hamaga," says a note, "means do not worry, or it doesn't matter."
It seemed to wait for an answer, for the owner of the face did not move up any further.
Christian nudged Big Tiger, and then they both said together, as if by mutual agreement, "Puchitso, we don't understand you."
"You Chinese or what?"
asked the voice in broken Chinese.
"We're from Peking," answered Christian.
"That good. I say first, no frighten."
"Come up to us," said Big Tiger bravely.
With one spring, the hitherto invisible figure leaped almost noiselessly into the truck. Big Tiger and Christian were astounded.
"Are you an acrobat?" asked Christian.
"No, I, Mongol of Chachar tribe. Batur, my unworthy name. Easy and safe be your road."
"So you're Batur," cried Christian. "Oh, that's fine. Lo Chang sends you greetings and a message. This is Big Tiger, and I'm Compass Mountain. Won't you sit down?"
They bowed to each other, Batur murmuring a salutation, which Big Tiger and Christian could not understand. Then Big Tiger went straight to the point.
"Green Coat has arrived," he said.
"Me see bad man already. Me have great fear," said Batur.
"Lo Chang says you must hurry on account of the camels, and you must be careful in the snow."
"Me understand," said Batur. "Me understand all. Perhaps forgive great hurry. Me come again soon."
When he stood up, Christian noticed that his feet were bare, but his long fur coat almost covered them. "Have you got no shoes?"
"Hamaga," said Batur. "Boots under car. No snow tread there. I back here soon."
Like an expert rider, leaping on his horse, Batur leaped over the side of the truck. His coat fluttered like a flag, and his leap was almost inaudible.
Christian and Big Tiger watched him as he glided swiftly across the yard, cleverly using everything in his path as cover. He had soon reached the south corner where the camels lay in the darkness, and one could not see what went on. For a while, all was silent. Then they heard the angry roar of a camel. Immediately afterwards, a figure in a fluttering coat, manipulating a rope, appeared on the wall of the courtyard, but only for a moment. Then Batur disappeared, and all was as before. The camels continued chewing the cud.
The wind blew over the roof of the inn Joyous Prosperity, and the snow fluttered down in little flakes.
"He's a fine athlete," said Christian approvingly.
"What's that?" asked Big Tiger.
"I mean that Bator is good at getting over walls."
"He can't fly over walls because he's not a cock. Did you hear that camel roaring?"
"Yes."
"Well, it roared because it was annoyed, and it was annoyed because it had to stand up."
"You mean that Bator had frightened it?"
"I know how things like that are done, and when I don't know, I think something up," Big Tiger explained.
"My father calls that making a diagnosis," said Christian. "It's often right, and it's often wrong."
"Good," said Big Tiger. "I make a diagnosis that the camels are lying very near the wall. There's a rope there fastened firmly in the ground. The men tie the camels to this rope with a short halter so that they can lie there and can sleep if they're tired. But sometimes someone wants to get away quickly in the night when the gate is shut without awakening the innkeeper to let him out. So he just goes to a camel lying near the wall and loosens the halter. The camel looks on, wondering what's doing. He then gets up on the camel and drums on its belly with his feet. The camel knows it can't be helped. It must stand up. And as it's night, it roars. Perhaps someone comes to see what's wrong. But if there's a wind blowing and it's snowing, no one comes. Naturally, that's much better than if someone comes and makes a row as if the stars were falling from heaven when it's only someone wanting to get away quietly without waking people up."
"Yes, that's much better. But what then?"
"When the camel stands up, he leaps nimbly from its back onto the wall, and that's all. He can then jump down the other side."
"But what if he wants to get back?" asked Christian.
"Then he must take a rope with him, which he has first fastened to a post or a car wheel or something that's lying around. He throws the rope over the wall and in this way can get back easily, and doesn't have to say thanks 10,000 times to anyone."
"And you think that Bator did that, and will soon be back?"
"That's what I think," said Big Tiger.
"Then let's get back into our sleeping bags."
Their sleeping bags were still warm, but the fur caps, which they had forgotten to cover, were full of snow.
"Ooh," said Big Tiger, "we must rig up some shelter from the snow, some kind of roof or something like that."
"That won't be necessary," Christian surmised. "We're soon getting into the desert, and it doesn't snow there. It's hot in the desert."
"It's not always hot in the Gobi Desert," Big Tiger maintained.
"Let's ask Bator when he comes back. I'm for its being hot in the desert."
"I'm for and against," said Big Tiger.
"Can you be both?" asked Christian, astonished.
Big Tiger reflected for a moment.
"It often seems wise to be both," he said.
"Shall we sleep for a while?" asked Christian.
"I'm for it," said Big Tiger.
"I am too. Do we agree?"
"We always agree."
"Even if it's hot in the desert?"
"Of course, since we're friends," said Big Tiger.
They slept very soundly and did not notice that it had stopped snowing and the wind had dropped. The last clouds drifted away and the stars appeared one after another. The pole star was there too, and the night was getting colder.
Bator did not return for a long time. He had had a lot to do. Indeed, never before had he got through so much work in so short a time. When at last he climbed up on the courtyard wall by the rope, he looked up at the stars and noticed it was already nearly 3. "It's the hour of the tiger," thought Bator. And a note tells us, in the old Chinese division of the day into 12 double hours, 3 to 5 a.m. is the hour of the tiger. "It's the hour of the tiger," thought Bator, "and when it is past, Yolros Lama will set out. I haven't much time." He looked into the courtyard where the camel had laid down again with the others. He could not jump onto its back, so he slid along the wall, looking for a convenient place from which to jump down. The truck was standing just near the entrance. The wheel marks and footsteps of the evening before had been snowed over. New footprints would be visible. But Bator consoled himself with the reflection that when the llama would be setting out, a lot of people and camels would be walking about the courtyard even before daylight. The only tracks left to betray his nocturnal wanderings would be on the short stretch of wall where he had swept off the snow when sliding along. Hamaga, thought Bator. He swung down onto the truck. Only the tips of the two sleepers' noses were visible. The rest of their faces was hidden in the fur caps. Bator did not know how he should awaken them. He would have liked to tweak their noses, but he didn't know them well enough for that. So he decided to say out loud
sa untavo, which means, have you slept well? And knowing this, we already know more Mongolian than Christian and Big Tiger, who didn't yet know a word. Despite this, they awoke all right, and Big Tiger said, good morning, Bator. How are you? And how are things at home? We house broken up, all packed. Camels take away soon, answered Bator. Christian sat up perplexed. Your house? He asked. How can you break up your house and pack it away? Bator was now perplexed, and Big Tiger explained, he means they've packed up their tent. Bator shook his head. Tent not there. You and you must learn Mongolian. Our houses, gears. We make of felt and staves, round as sun and warm and quick to pack. We call your houses yurts, said Christian. To all foreigners are gears, yurts, said Bator. We Mongols. That's enough, said Big Tiger. Kwee-chan and I want to learn Mongolian later, but there isn't time now. Tell us your news. Bator scratched his head, looked up at the stars, and said, could say much, but soon hour of the hare. That's 5 to 7 a.m. And Bator have very cold feet. Bator shiver. Sit near me, said Christian, holding his sleeping bag open. It's warm in here. Stick in your feet. There's room for both of us. Thousand times thousand thanks, said Bator. I tell story easy now.